Welcome to Oncology Today, Frontline Treatment of Chronic Lymphocytic Leukemia Edition, a special program focused on recently published and emerging clinical research. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this program, I met with Dr. John Pagel from the Swedish Cancer Institute in Seattle. In addition to this audio podcast, there's also a video presentation component. To begin, I asked Dr. Pagel to comment on the issue of treatment versus observation. So I want to begin by asking you, what do you consider sort of the key factors of the evaluation of a patient presenting with CLL? What biomarkers do you look at? What clinical factors do you look at? And how do you decide whether to treat the patient or not?
Yeah, it's probably the most important question you can ask, right? So it's very important to understand the genetic risk for these patients. A FISH test should be done to look for genetic aberrations. You want to make sure a patient doesn't have a 17p deletion. I do also think it's important to sequence for TP53 aberrations. Remember, you can have mutations in TP53, but not have a deletion of 17p, where, of course, TP53 resides. So you can have mutations or deletions of TP53 that you need to know about. 11Qs are also important to understand. So a FISH test to look for those features are important, not just for understanding the prognosis, but really starting to think about how you're going to sequence treatment early on. So FISH test is important. You also want to look at the mutational status of the immunoglobulin heavy chain. That's a one-time test. That doesn't evolve and change over time. So you're going to want to look for if the patient's undergone somatic hypermutation or not. I always like to say it's good to be a mutant. So that's going to be the rearrangement of those immunoglobulin genes. That mutational status is a normal process. It happens in more mature cells, and the more mature the cell is that develops the CLL, where mutation has happened, the more indolent the disease is going to behave. You want to have that information for, again, assessing the patient and following them closely. I don't typically do CT scans, assess for bulky disease or anything of the like, unless patients have an 11q deletion. Those are the patients who have bulky disease most often. They can have very big spleens. Those are people that you might want to know about lymph node disease burden. But in general, you don't need to do scans. And we really make then an assessment, a clinical assessment, if people need treatment or not. Even in 2020, it's very important to remember we don't treat patients unless we have a reason to. So if we don't have a reason to treat patients, we just watch them. It's what we call active surveillance. I don't like to use the term with my patients anymore, watch and wait. They don't like that. So I say active surveillance, and I wait until I see a reason to get treated. So that might be symptoms. You know, most people aren't going to have B symptoms with CLL, but weight loss of 10% of the body weight or more, uncontrolled fevers, certainly drenching night sweats. It might be symptomatic adenopathy or splenomegaly that would drive treatment. It might be a rapidly rising absolute lymphocyte count, a doubling time of 6 months or less. Those are the things we have to see, even in high-risk disease patients. We do not have any evidence that treating even those patients early is going to help someone live longer if they're asymptomatic and don't have a reason to be treated. So we put all that together, and we either watch and, I should say, actively surveil the patient, or if a patient needs treatment, then we really kind of think about the treatment options for them. That also is a very nuanced approach, to be honest. It's different for every single patient, how you approach the idea of how you would treat a patient in the front line. Every patient's different. They have different goals and they have different needs. There's some people that have very aggressive disease and you need to be very aggressive in your treatment. That's a vast minority of patients who present like that. Most people have relatively indolent disease. Their lymphocyte counts now going up a little bit too fast. And you have to understand about where they are, what their comorbidities are. Very important to understand what other therapies they're on, what their goals are true with regard to a desire for time-limited or finite therapies, or are they able to tolerate and do well with ongoing indefinite daily use therapy? Really, where would they be as well when they relapse is something I'm going to think about too, Neil. And so those are all things that you put together and have a conversation with on each individual patient.
So I'm curious whether the paradigm of to treat or not treat in your mind has changed at all with the evolution of, you know, novel therapies, and whether you see patients as sort of push back. You know, you might have a patient who's a doc or whatever, very uncomfortable seeing their white count up, et cetera. Why can't I just try ibrutinib? But do you ever encounter that, and how do you respond to it?
Well, yeah, that happens every day, to be honest. People, no one wants this disease, even though we like to tell people, you know, you're going to do well. It's still a malignancy, and no one wants this. And we need to, of course, continue to work towards curing these patients. But when you start explaining to patients that we don't have really curative therapies with standard treatment approaches, and that if I'm going to treat you when you're completely asymptomatic, all I'm probably going to be doing is giving you potential to feel bad. Maybe I'm going to cause a problem. And when you kind of put that into context, those patients, almost always invariably get it. Now, they do want to think about other things. They're going to ask you, well, geez, what can I do? If I'm not going to get treatment, can I have a diet that really approaches the biology of the disease and changes the natural history of my disease? Or can exercise overcome biology? Or, of course, one of the major things that we've talked a lot about are supplements. That's a conversation that's very common. And, you know, I think I always come back to patients and say, hey, it's really common sense, and it's well-balanced meals. It's alcohol in moderation. It's certainly reasonable to take supplements that appear appropriate and healthy and that aren't crazy on the extreme. And, you know, people will bring up things like green tea extract and some data that suggests it might be helpful. And I say, it's great. Try that. Let's hope for the best. But overall, at the end of the day, once patients start, you know, understanding that biology is going to rule the day, the dust settles, they get reassured, they come in a time or two and they don't see that their white count is changing dramatically. It's typically a setting that level sets, and people can often accept the fact that despite the unfortunate nature of having the disease, they're going to do well.
Another issue, and you know, certainly you being in Seattle, which is really one of the places that where COVID was started in the United States, comes up, which is the question, how does treatment affect the risk of getting COVID or the risk of getting severe COVID? Some of these agents, including BTK inhibitors, have actually been used in an attempt to treat COVID. What's your best estimate of how these different therapies affect those risks?
Yeah, it's a super important question that we, of course, don't have the answer to completely at this point. I will say that we've looked at this as best we can, and I say as best we can because it's a study that we did retrospectively evaluating COVID patients who have CLL. It was a flawed study in many ways. It's highly biased. It's highly biased to centers that are tertiary referral centers that have higher risk patients, and those are important things to understand. But it did suggest that if you have CLL, you're at a higher risk for having complications related to COVID. So, of course, the first thing I want to say is do everything you can not to get COVID. We know that, right? It's masks, it's hand washing, it's staying away from sick people. But we do have to live life, and we do have to take care of CLL and treat those patients. We looked at the patients who either were on therapy or off of therapy who got COVID and had CLL, and it suggested that perhaps that the therapies didn't prevent the infections, but they actually may have made the complications related to COVID less. So maybe there was less significant complications if you were on, in particular, a BTK inhibitor. And you alluded to this, Neil. There's some data that suggests that we might be able to help people treat their COVID, actually, even with a BTK inhibitor, even if they don't have CLL. Now, that's just some early data that's driven by some underlying science. We haven't proven that in the clinic. There are some significant trials going on right now, trying to explore that in COVID patients. But I would argue that if you need treatment, don't come off of treatment for your CLL if you get COVID. I don't think it's going to have an impact in that regard, especially in my experience. But you're going to have to take it as an individual case and discuss that, of course, with your treating physicians and providing team.
So I'm curious if you could talk a little bit more about the normal role of IGVH and maybe the sort of the pathophysiology or physiology of that in terms of CLL and also normal function.
Well, it's important. Of course, remember that these B lymphocytes have a job to do. You know, they're born in the bone marrow. They become adolescents. They like to leave the house and they go start circulating in the blood. They're looking for a place to live. They want to live in lymphatic tissue. And so they find a home in lymph nodes and they're going to hang out there until they have their job to do. And that job is, of course, primarily to fight infections, keep us happy, keep us healthy. So they're going to hang out there in the lymph nodes until there's some antigenic stimulation, typically. We do recognize that that's happening in the business portion of the lymph node, the germinal center of the lymph node. And B lymphocytes normally will migrate through that germinal center and mature and go on to eventually formulate, develop into a plasma cell that will be an antibody secreting cell to fight that specific invading organism or foreign agent. During that process, we know that these immunoglobulin genes, the VDJ and heavy chain genes, will be rearranged. And that rearrangement is critically important for developing a very vast repertoire of antibodies that we can have to fight many, many different infectious agents, millions of different agents. That's a process we call somatic hypermutation. And that's a process that happens normally. So an immunoglobulin heavy chain gene is rearranged with those other VDJ genes, the light chain genes, to create a novel specific immunoglobulin gene that's eventually expressed and secreted in from a plasma cell that will again fight those infections. So we know that that process, you can think of it as taking time, and it happens in those cells that have undergone somatic hypermutation, mutational rearrangement through the germinal center of the lymph node. And if it comes out the backside, it's a more mature cell. That more mature B lymphocyte can then have something go wrong. Of course, that something go wrong is CLL, and it's making too many of the same cells, proliferation, and the cells don't die like they're supposed to. But those cells that have undergone that process have now really evolved to be very indolent, mature cells, much more like a normal B lymphocyte, even if they have underlying malignant potential. At the opposite end of the spectrum of those cells that, you know, you can think of as just getting into the germinal center and have not undergone somatic hypermutation, they're unmutated. They're more immature. And if they're more immature, they're going to behave a little more aggressively. They're going to actually lead to earlier relapses and even shorter survival compared to those CLL cells that have undergone mutations in the IGH gene.
So I want to talk a little bit more about the choice of first-line therapy. First, the focus on the issue of BTK versus obinutuzumab / venetoclax. And let me ask you, are there any situations where you would use anything else first-line at this point? I mean, I guess you could bring up FCR as a possibility. Is that something you consider in a younger patient with mutated disease?
Well, it's an important question. You know, where we are is that in the front line, we really have three major choices. They're B BTK inhibitors. And again, we have two approved agents, ibrutinib and acalabrutinib, but many others are coming down the pike in that class of drugs. And we have BCL2 inhibitors. The only one we have at this point is venetoclax. As you mentioned, you could use anti-CD20 antibodies with those agents. And the third class is chemoimmunotherapy. Based on the upfront data from the Illuminate trial that randomized BTK inhibitor to chlorambucil and obinutuzumab in older patients, the older patient trial of ibrutinib or ibrutinib and rituximab versus BR in older patients, and the younger ECOG trial randomizing ibrutinib and rituximab to FCR, we've really shown in the vast majority of patients, there's really no role for chemoimmunotherapy anymore in the frontline setting. And that even includes, of course, and especially high-risk patients, except, as you note, perhaps those most favorable risk patients who could still benefit from FCR if they're younger and fit and can tolerate the therapy. So that's based on data we have primarily from the MD Anderson Cancer Center, looking at patients who have favorable risk disease. They're the immunoglobulin heavy chain mutated patients. I told you those are the more indolent, favorable patients. If they're younger and fit and they get FCR, we have long-term data, 14, 15-year follow-up data saying that about 60% of those patients can at least be functionally cured, never relapse, not one time. There's, of course, a downside to that, Neil. That means that, well, 40% of patients got FCR and they still relapsed. So we can't predict who's going to relapse and who won't relapse, unfortunately. The other thing that's important to recognize is that FCR is a tough regimen. Even in younger, fit patients, you can have prolonged, significant cytopenias, and there's risk for infections. So you definitely need prophylactic therapies to prevent opportunistic infections. And we do recognize there's a 5% or so risk of long-term, or I should say late-term second malignancies, including acute myeloid leukemia or myelodysplasia. So, you know, I love the idea of giving a younger patient with really favorable risk disease, a mutated IGH patient, FCR, and hopefully actually giving them a quote-unquote cure, that four-letter word that we never have used in CLL. But I do it with trepidation, to be honest, because I worry about long-term problems in that kind of patient who I'm trying to get to live another 30 or 40 years. You know, you do see patients in their 40s with CLL, unfortunately. It's not nearly as common, but it happens. And the appeal there is great, but there's lots of potential long-term problems. And let me just say, if you look at the upfront ECOG trial that randomized patients to ibrutinib and rituximab versus FCR, and you look at the subset of patients who were young, fit, and mutated, where we love to think of the gold standard FCR, the ibrutinib and rituximab curve is really overlapping the FCR curve in those favorable patients. Now, the problem is we don't have the follow-up with ibrutinib and rituximab that we have with FCR. So they could start falling off, but it's perhaps reasonable to be thinking even in those younger fit patients that we would be even using targeted therapy there, and maybe we're going to avoid those cytopenias or the risk for AML or MDS. Of course, Neil, the downside of with that is another 30 years or so on an oral targeted therapy. You know, I'm not sure that that's exactly how it would play out. We have to find out. And there's downsides to that. And that leads to the idea then is that even in patients who are getting BTK inhibitors in the front line, we need to really be thinking about how we can stop treatment in those patients as well. This idea of indefinite therapy isn't really required for every single patient. We need that data. I'll just mention one of the ways we're trying to get that data is combinations of therapies, targeted therapies in the front line, getting deeper remissions where we can stop treatment.
I have actually heard people talk about stopping a BTK inhibitor in patients who are lower risk and doing really well, indolent disease. Do you ever do that?
You know, I'll tell you, we all have these patients who got put on ibrutinib And, you know, they got on ibrutinib and they're doing really well. And then all of a sudden something happens that's a problem for them. I've had people with really, you know, significant rashes that have had to come off of therapy or holding the drug as an example. And you're having to hold the drug now for several weeks. I mean, I've had a rash or two with ibrutinib where I've had to hold the drug for, you know, months till that rash was gone. And then now the rash is gone and you ask yourself, okay, should we restart the ibrutinib? And you notice that their blood counts are perfectly fine. They feel great. You know, you can't feel any adenopathy on exam. You know they have CLL. You know they're going to relapse. But the patients can ask you, well, why do I need to go back on treatment? You told me early on that you don't treat unless you have a reason. And I have had people that have stayed off a drug for 2-3 years in that kind of setting. These are favorable patients, remember? They have 13q deletions, which is the most common aberration to have for CLL. You know, they are young, and they're—I shouldn't say young, but they're fit. They're doing fine. They're watched closely. We definitely need to know who we can safely stop therapy on. And fortunately, you know, we're kind of starting to do those trials even with single agent BTK inhibitors now.
So I'm curious when the last time is that you started a patient on FCR.
More than 6 years ago.
Wow, really?
I see hundreds of CLL patients a year, hundreds. Ask perhaps how many times I've used BR in the last 6 years. One time.
Wow.
I'm talking, of course, off of a clinical trial. So I've used chemoimmunotherapy off of a clinical trial in the last 6 years, one time.
We had a case the other day with somebody brought up that they wanted to put on a BTK inhibitor, but the patient was sick and it was going to take a while to actually get the BTK inhibitor. And they gave BR as sort of a temporizing strategy. Have you ever done that?
Yeah, but I would likely do something a little different, to be honest. I'm more of a fan of just giving single agent antibody to control disease, maybe obinutuzumab there. Or if you're in really a tight bind, give some high dose solumedrol. Give a gram of solumedrol daily for 4 days. The patient will tolerate it just fine and will have dramatic improvement in their symptoms or disease control. And then you're getting your BTK inhibitor in hand and able to go. Once you commit to the BR, it's kind of hard to say, oh, I'm just going to give a cycle or so, especially because you just don't know really where that's going to end up for a patient. I don't think it's unreasonable to do if you're trying to, you know, bridge, so to speak, as you mentioned, but it wouldn't be my first choice.
So, of course, I want to get into the granularity of how you see the trade-off between BTK and venetoclax, obinutuzumab. But I'm also curious, if you kind of take a step back and look at these two approaches, how you kind of think through the global tolerability issues. So it's not just side effects. It's, as you mentioned before, inconvenience. You have now kind of COVID getting layered on top of that, people not liking to come in as much as maybe they did 6 months ago. From your point of view, from the point of view of efficacy, do you kind of consider them equivalent, BTK and venetoclax?
I guess my answer, Neil, would be yes and no. If you look on paper, you know, meaning from clinical trials, the venetoclax is certainly a more efficacious agent. You're going to have more complete remissions with venetoclax than you are with ibrutinib or acalabrutinib. And you're definitely, in some patients, going to achieve an undetectable minimal residual disease state in the blood and even in the bone marrow with venetoclax, which you will not get with a BTK inhibitor. So the answer there, that part, yes, from an efficacy standpoint, they are different. And that's why, of course, you can potentially stop venetoclax at some point, we know. But the no part of it is, does it really matter? We know that CLL patients who get partial remissions from single agent ibrutinib or acalabrutinib are going to do well for long periods of time without getting a complete remission, without being undetectable MRD. So, you know, the answer is clear. Yeah, efficacy is better, but you have to put it into context of what's important and valuable and meaningful for that individual patient who you're treating.
So to try to drill down a little bit more in terms of choice, first in terms of choice of BTK, You met in your patients that you presented, you mentioned acalabrutinib. Is that in general your first-line BTK inhibitor, or are there specific situations where you would favor, for example, ibrutinib?
Well, I want to first say that, these BTK inhibitors and ibrutinib and acalabrutinib have been game changers. I mean, ibrutinib was the paradigm shift. That drug has been revolutionary in this disease, no question. But I do think we've advanced the field with acalabrutinib. My personal experience is that it's a better tolerated therapy. There are downsides to acalabrutinib. One is that it's a BID drug, whereas ibrutinib is a once-a-day drug. So, there might be a patient where you're worried about compliance. We did do a study, actually. It was not a great study, Neil, but where we looked at Medicare claims data with oral oncolytics in patients taking a once-a-day or twice-a-day drug and showed that there was no adherence differences. But, it's within limitations of a big retrospective study looking at how often prescriptions are filled in that. We know, just getting off the subject there a little bit, but we know that even with once-a-day dosing, adherence can be a problem. But acala is a twice-a-day dosing drug. We also recognize that acala, you cannot take it, acalabrutinib, you can't take it on a proton pump inhibitor. You need an acidic stomach. Ibrutinib doesn't have any of those kinds of limitations. But I will tell you that I do truly believe that there's a difference in the side effect profile that can relate to the fact that acalabrutinib interacts with fewer off-target tyrosine kinases than does ibrutinib. So, I've treated lots and lots of people with acalabrutinib, and I just have not ever seen a rash with that drug. I have seen lots of rashes with ibrutinib. Same thing with regard to arthralgias or myalgias, way less with acalabrutinib. And I'll just tell you another piece of data or so that helps with that, at least for me, is that now we have two studies that we've published looking at taking patients who are intolerant to ibrutinib and transitioning them to acalabrutinib because of that ibrutinib intolerance. And that's with all kinds of intolerant adverse events that can happen, including atrial fibrillation. And what we've shown is that in the vast majority of patients, if you're intolerant or failing ibrutinib because of intolerance and you switch to acalabrutinib, you can rescue them without the same adverse event or toxicity coming back. And if it were to come back, it's usually at a lower grade. So acalabrutinib is something that you can even use when people are not tolerating ibrutinib well. We have a randomized trial that we're waiting for the data on, Neil. It's a randomized trial in relapsed high-risk CLL of acalabrutinib versus ibrutinib. And it's a non-inferiority trial for efficacy. So, there's not a lot of events yet, and we've been waiting for the data. But where we are really waiting for the data is to see if there's any difference in adverse events. My hunch is that there are, and I'll even tell you one other thing that will help give a clue to that, is that in a different disease, relapsed Waldenstrom's macroglobulinemia, there was recently a trial known as the Aspen trial where patients were randomized to get ibrutinib or to get even a different BTK inhibitor, zanubrutinib, which we haven't talked about. It's approved in relapsed mantle cell, not in CLL yet, zanubrutinib. But in this trial in Waldenstrom's randomized zanubrutinib versus ibrutinib, the adverse events were far less with zanubrutinib than they were with ibrutinib. One example, atrial fibrillation was 18% in those relapsed Waldenstrom's patients with ibrutinib. It was only 3% with the zanubrutinib. So the drugs are different. And, do I have any problem with ibrutinib? Absolutely not. But if I have to choose, I'm going to give the drug that I think is going to be the best tolerated. And for me so far, that's been acalabrutinib.
So I'm curious, I have this sort of pet theory I've been asking people about related to headache that you mentioned with acalabrutinib. And from what I've heard, you don't see that headache with zanubrutinib, correct?
The data is very clear that there are very low rates of headache with zanubrutinib.
So I've always been fascinated by that, the thing with the caffeine and all. I always thought it was so interesting. And I guess one of the things I was wondering about is, do you think there's a possibility that trial comparing acalabrutinib and ibrutinib would show a difference in efficacy? I mean, everybody's looking for the toxicity data. I think everybody's expecting you're not going to see a difference. But do you think it's possible that something like the headache could be, you know, part of an on-target effect that in fact has a therapeutic benefit? I know it seems kind of crazy, but it's kind of curious what you think.
I think it's a fascinating idea. It does ask, why are the acalabrutinib patients getting a headache? You know, what would be a cause for that? It makes you wonder if it has something to do with getting into tissue compartments deeper or changing nitric oxide levels for vasodilatation or not, or restriction, I should say. I think all of those could certainly play on an efficacy standpoint. The problem with that trial, it's a non-inferiority trial, so I don't know if we'll, you know, really it's not going to be powered to show a difference. And my hunch is we won't see a difference in that regard. But there's some reason that we have to really do some good science on to ask, why would you get a headache with acalabrutinib when you wouldn't with ibrutinib or zanubrutinib?
So continuing on in terms of, you know, looking into this comparison right now, and particularly in terms of BTK or not, I guess another question is anti-CD20 or not. And, you know, we know the data, there's a little bit of suggestive data with acalabrutinib, not too much with ibrutinib. Are there situations where you use anti-CD20 with BTK?
Rarely. I don't think that it's wrong to do. I wouldn't fault anyone if they added an anti-CD20 antibody to ibrutinib or acalabrutinib. Frankly, I should be more clear. That would be obinutuzumab, at least in the front line, not rituximab. I want to reiterate, we have now two good randomized trials with or without rituximab, ibrutinib with or without rituximab in the front line, showing no difference in outcomes, progression-free survival for those patients. So rituximab doesn't add any benefit in the front line. The obinutuzumab might. We certainly have that data from the ELEVATE trial of using acalabrutinib, either as a monotherapy or with obinutuzumab. And we clearly do see an improvement in progression-free survival with the obinutuzumab. But it comes at a cost, too. And in particular, there are infusion-related reactions that happen with obinutuzumab that can be, you know, really significant, especially on that first infusion. I will also say, if you look closely at the data, there's much more neutropenia when you add the obinutuzumab and more febrile neutropenia. So and then also keep in mind, we're trying to really get away from these infusional therapies. That's the whole idea here. So, you know, patients don't want a port if they don't have to have a port. They don't want to come in for all these infusions. So I'm not curing these people by adding the anti-CD20 antibody. So I'm not a big fan of it. It just causes some more toxicity and inconvenience for patients. Now, I will say, you could easily imagine that there are some patients where you'd say, I'm going to do it. And I have. Those are people that their disease is like really going, and I want to get on top of their disease really quickly. And I love single agent obinutuzumab in that setting, or I should say even as a precursor to getting the BTK inhibitor on board, as we kind of talked about a few minutes ago. But those patients don't come along that often. But, you know, clearly obinutuzumab, it's a very powerful anti-CD20 antibody in CLL when you need it.
I was interviewing Carrie Rogers the other day, and she was talking about the work that they've done at Ohio State, and I know you've been involved with that too, looking at resistance to BTK inhibitors and measuring resistance, actually beginning to start to utilize it clinically. Where are we with that?
Well, you know, it's still a research tool, but it's important to know about and to understand, and in particular because we're learning about, you know, how to take care of patients that develop these resistance problems. So remember that with CLL and BTK therapy, BTK inhibitor therapy like ibrutinib or acalabrutinib, that when they fail, the vast majority of patients, more than 90% of patients, are going to fail because of a mutation that develops either in the BTK binding pocket in amino acid position 481, a cysteine to usually a serine change there, or downstream PLC gamma 2 mutation. Those are the vast majority and most in that 481 position of the BTK binding pocket. What happens, of course, is that the drug does interact appropriately with BTK in that way and doesn't work. Those drugs, ibrutinib and acalabrutinib, are what we call irreversible covalent binding drugs. So they need to bind there and stay there. And if they don't do that, patients are going to become resistant and escape. Or again, maybe there's a mutation downstream, PLC gamma 2, where there is escape because of a mutation there. What we are learning about is that that happens. And when that happens, people, of course, are going to relapse. But we know that early data suggests we might be able to rescue, not might, we appear to be able to rescue patients with now what we call third generation BTK inhibitors that are in advanced development. I'll point out two that people really want to keep an eye out for, at least I'm excited about. One is known as LOXO-305, LOXO-305, and the other is ARQ-531 or ARQ-531. These are now reversible, non-covalent binding BTK inhibitors that can cycle on and off and overcome the resistance that develops in that BTK binding pocket. And we have shown early, we need, of course, to really get more data, but that we can rescue patients who are resistant to ibrutinib, as an example, because of that type of mutation, and keep them in the same class of drugs, BTK binding, BTK inhibitor therapies, and keep venetoclax as an example in our back pocket. So it's still research, and we're still trying to figure out when we test for it and know about it. And I think we're going to want to use it and think about it in those third generation, when we're thinking about using those third generation BTK inhibitors when they become available.
So I want to go through a few side effects issues with both of these strategies, beginning with BTK inhibitors, both of the acalabrutinib as well as ibrutinib. I want to start out with arthralgias.
Yeah, you know, the arthralgias are a problem with ibrutinib, much less so with acalabrutinib. They can actually be debilitating in a small number of patients. Muscle aches, joint pains, where the patients are even taking, fortunately, again, not commonly, but narcotics. I don't like seeing my patients with CLL suffer. So, yeah, you know, if I'm providing them something that has a chance to cure them or whatever, then we're going to put up with some side effects. But, you know, we shouldn't have to do that here. Venetoclax does not have that kind of adverse event profile. You don't see things like arthralgias or myalgias with venetoclax.
And of course, the big issue in terms of bleeding, atrial fibrillation, cardiovascular effects. First of all, can you talk a little bit about the incidence and how you approach patients like that? How comfortable are you using, for example, acalabrutinib in a patient who's anticoagulated?
So it's a question we face every single day in the clinic. The majority of patients who have CLL are older and they're on an anticoagulant. So, I don't underestimate the bleeding concerns and risks. Where we really get into trouble with BTK inhibitors is if people are on antiplatelet agents in particular, like clopidogrel or even an aspirin. Remember that BTK inhibitors also hit TEC, kinase that's in platelets, and that inhibits the ability of the platelets to aggregate to collagen. And so taking a BTK inhibitor like ibrutinib is like taking, you can think of it as like taking an antiplatelet agent, like an aspirin. So, I've early on when we started using ibrutinib, got into some really serious bleeding issues with people who were on clopidogrel as an example. So when I see someone who needs to be on an agent like that for a cardiac stent, I'm much more likely to maybe go with venetoclax, where I'm not going to see that kind of bleeding risk. I will tell you that if I do need to treat someone with a BTK inhibitor and they have an risk for anticoagulation, I'm going to go with acalabrutinib. If you look at the data, for acalabrutinib, if you're on an antiplatelet or antithrombotic agent, like a direct inhibitor, the risk is increased over those who are not on those agents, but it's minimally increased. It's increased to about 5% to have a major bleed from about 3%. So the risk will go up. But, you know, that those are risks I want to avoid. And if I have venetoclax, I'm more inclined to use that agent.
So let's talk a little bit more about venetoclax. And of course, one of the key issues there, at least in the upfront setting, is MRD measurement and whether you take any action based on that. Can you talk about what your approach is?
Well, you know, I think this is also a moving target. We're still trying to figure it out. Certainly in the community, we're not actively looking for minimal residual disease, even if you, in the setting of upfront venetoclax. But let me remind patients, venetoclax is approved upfront in combination with obinutuzumab with the idea that you can stop treatment at a year, time-limited therapy or finite therapy. Of course, that's appealing in many ways to patients. And the vast majority of patients are getting that regimen become undetectable for MRD by standard flow cytometric analysis in the blood and often in the bone marrow. So that means they're at a 10 to the minus fourth level. They're below that. You can't find one malignant CLL cell in a sea of up to 10,000 lymphocytes or white blood cells. You know, that's a pretty good remission. Now, we also know that a fair number of those people can actually even have remissions deeper than that, 10 to the minus six. So if you're doing next generation sequencing, you can actually show that venetoclax and obinutuzumab in that frontline setting can get to that level of undetectable MRD. What I would say is that it's still largely a research tool. I do it in the front line. I want to know if in the peripheral blood at a year, if my patient is undetectable for MRD, at least by flow cytometry. If they are, I feel very comfortable stopping therapy at that point. Now, if they're not, my practice actually is to largely continue therapy with the single agent venetoclax at that point. I also want to point out one specific patient population to keep in mind around that, and those are the higher risk patients. Those patients with 17p deletions, those patients who had TP53 aberration, even if you've got an undetectable MRD, stopping the venetoclax at a year is likely going to lead to a relatively early relapse. So I don't stop those patients either. So I like to check for MRD at a year. It's simple. It's just sending flow cytometry on peripheral blood. You don't need to do a bone marrow. There's good correlation there. It's not perfect. You're going to have people that are negative in the blood and positive in the marrow, but that's okay. It'll give you some reassurance to know that if you're in a very good remission, stopping treatment's okay. The patient will want to know that. It'll be really valuable for the patient to feel comfortable in stopping. You know, I've had patients, Neil, who've said to me, well, geez, you know, if my MRD is, you know, only 10 to the minus second, and you're telling me that if I stop treatment, I'll probably relapse sooner rather than later, then I don't want to stop therapy. And, you know, again, it comes down to individual discussions around the patient and the goals of the patient. But that's a general approach where I think we're really heading with that type of assessment.
And I can tell you from having polled a clinical investigator that there's a consensus, just kidding, not a consensus at all about what to do with the MRD positive patients. It's like 50-50 in terms of stopping. I was curious what you were going to say. I can never seem to predict. But in any event, at least everybody stops if they are MRD negative. That's one thing. What about the issue of the practical use of venetoclax? I know you had a paper in Clinical Cancer Research about, you know, some patients that were treated with venetoclax in terms of adverse events. And of course, there's a whole TLS prevention thing, so to speak. Can you talk about how you approach that? And also, do you use the exact letter of the package insert in terms of determining what to do, or do you have some variation with that?
Maybe the most important thing we're talking about, TLS is rare. Fortunately, it's really rare with how we approach patients with venetoclax, but if it does happen, it can be life-threatening. So it should never be underestimated, in my opinion. Remember, with venetoclax, there's a ramp-up schedule. takes about 5 weeks. You're going from 20 milligrams, you know, early on, then 50 for a week, 100, 200, trying to get to 400 milligrams, your stable dose. You know, when we approach patients and look at them, we put them into different risk groups for TLS, tumor lysis syndrome. They're either high risk, intermediate risk, or low risk. The high risk patients, I never underestimate my level of concern for them and TLS. Those are people with disease more than 5 centimeters in bulk, or a white or lymphocyte count greater than 25,000. Now, which patient do you know who needs treatment for their CLL who doesn't have a elevated lymphocyte count? So that's why the way to approach it, in my opinion now, is to give anti-CD20 antibody first without the venetoclax. Run in with your anti-CD20 antibody. If it's in the front line, it's obinutuzumab. If it's in the relapse setting, it can be rituximab. Run in with that over a month. I usually take 2 or even 3 months with just the anti-CD20 antibody because it will get the disease under control and people will tolerate it fine. And now you've reduced tumor lysis risk from high to intermediate or even from high down to low. And you can feel much more confident and better of using venetoclax. But don't get away from the ramp up. That's my opinion, Neil. I hear people do all kinds of different things. I do foliage to package insert here. And I think if you don't, you're setting yourself up for other concerns. At least my opinion would say that. So, you're going to perhaps not have to put people in the hospital to watch them. Again, if you debulk them with the obinutuzumab, but still check the labs, still check the tumor lysis labs. And pay attention to that, but you're going to do fine. I can't tell you, I've treated so many people with venetoclax now and know that I can mitigate the tumor lysis risk by the ramp up and introducing an anti-CD20 antibody first. I will say, if there are patients who don't have high disease burdens or what have you, I don't think you have to use the anti-CD20 antibody. You could get right in the venetoclax, but still do the ramp up.
So I had a case the other day presented to me by a general medical oncologist, really smart person. And from what I could tell, this patient had biochemical TLS with acalabrutinib. Have you ever heard of that?
It's been described in all the clinical trial data, I believe, Neil, one time. It's extremely uncommon with ibrutinib as well. But, of course it can happen. I think the more interesting question about that from the flip side is, why doesn't it happen, right? You'll take a patient with a white count of, or lymphocyte count of 200,000 and you'll give them a acalabrutinib and you tell them to come back in a month. We're going to check your blood counts in a month and you don't even worry about why don't we get tumor lysis in those patients. I've wondered about that so much and asked so many questions and looked at that. I guess the good news is we just don't. But know that it can happen. Fortunately, it's quite rare.
Yeah, well, the thing about this, this patient just clinically was cruising, but this doc was drawing a lot of blood and saw it and, held the dose, whatever. I wonder whether maybe it was happening and people weren't, hearing about it or seeing it.
I wonder in some of those cases if they're also giving an anti-CD20 antibody or if they're giving steroids or anything else that could contribute. It'd be rare, very rare to see it with single agent BTK inhibitor.
So getting back to the choice between these two strategies in general, it's hard to kind of tell exactly, but I had the feeling going into the end of 2019 that sort of venetoclax was gaining momentum. People like the short-term treatment. And then I can't exactly document it, but I kind of had the feeling that people took another breath once COVID came in terms of the issue of having to bring people, even in to draw blood, et cetera. Any comment about that? Does your view of that trade-off changed at all? I'm not sure exactly what the situation is in Seattle, but I don't think it's very good anywhere right now. But I'm just curious, does this enter into your thinking at this point?
I think you're 100% right on. I think the pendulum has swung. It swung way over, started to really gain momentum. Venetoclax, even for me, it was a surprise, even in the community. And then it's really come back more towards the center. And actually, I think it comes back again to the ease of use and staying out of the hospital for these patients and staying out of the infusion room for these patients. I also will say that I'm always struck by the community oncologists who worked so incredibly hard and has so many balls in the air of understanding, you know, all these malignancies that I would, you know, I'm at risk for failing my boards on breast cancer and colon cancer. But, you know, adding an additional risk of tumor lysis to them is becoming burdensome in some settings. So, you know, I still think in the community, the simplicity of use in a patient population that you don't see a ton of every single year, you can do well with ibrutinib or acalabrutinib is probably going to be where we end up settling out even after COVID.
I guess the other question is, are we eventually going to be moving towards a combination approach? There are tons of trials looking at BTK plus venetoclax. I don't know when we'll start seeing maturing of those studies. Any predictions about where we're going to land?
Well, it's now the next fascinating question. You will see data from the CAPTIVATE trial that we did relatively soon of using ibrutinib and venetoclax as a combination. What's the appeal there? The appeal is that you get a really deep, fantastic remission where, again, you can stop therapy and keep people off of treatment for long periods of time. And maybe, you know, maybe those people don't relapse. They have what I like to say are functional cures. Who knows? We'll see. I think the important thing to know is that when you use combinations, you're increasing the toxicities. So there is going to be more adverse events with more agents. And you're really not able to know what to do when people relapse, if and when they relapse after they've had two therapies or three therapies. So, you know, here I got a patient, I'll have them on ibrutinib and venetoclax as an example. And now they have an adverse event. I got to figure out, geez, which drug do I hold or which drug do I dose reduce or do I do both? And then if they relapse, I don't know if I can continue one of them or if I should continue both of them or stop both of them. And then lastly, remember, we still don't know, and we may never know, unfortunately, if combinations are better or worse than sequential therapy, especially with regard to progression-free survival. So you can imagine you've got a 72-year-old patient who you treat with ibrutinib or acalabrutinib in the front line. They get a 5-year remission. Then you give them a venetoclax. They get another 3 years. You've got 8 years. You're 80 years old there. Are you going to get 8 years with ibrutinib and venetoclax in the front line? I don't know. And I think we really should do that kind of trial. The problem with the trial, as you know, is that these people are, you know, have to be followed for years and years and years. And we have to, of course, assess for overall survival. And that's a very unappealing trial to do. Maybe that's where MRD comes in as our surrogate, Neil. So, and I'll also lastly say, of course, remember, now we're looking at three drugs too. So, it's adding an anti-CD20 antibody to ibrutinib and venetoclax, which doesn't appear to be a major advance over just ibrutinib and venetoclax as a doublet. I do want to say, I think for the majority of patients, more is not necessarily better. It's a research question right now. You know, we're never going to stop turning over rocks with regard to seeing what's under them for research in CLL. It's what keeps us in business. And I think we should be doing that, but where it plays out for patient care, I think we're doing pretty well right now with sequential therapy too.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Pagel, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for this special Oncology Today edition, Frontline Treatment of Chronic Lymphocytic Leukemia.